the slow realization that like the look of the hand stitch and the bigger spacing and the bigger thread is kind of not what people are into in the boot world. That was like a total abrupt realization for myself there, where I think you were like,
oh, sorry, I didn't know if that was like a tough call. Sorry.
No, it's this is a good story, but it starts off, it's like, who's this fancy guy from New York saying SPI? What's going on here?
ShoeCast. Welcome to the Stitch Down ShoeCast, where we talk quality footwear, how it's made, and all the things we love about it. I'm Ben from StitchDown.com, and today I'm quite excited indeed to be chatting with the just ridiculously talented man they call Bob Henderson. Bob is the operations manager at Popov Leather, the bustling leather goods workshop over yonder in British Columbia, Canada, and over the last few years has been sucked up by the indomitable tractor beam known as handmade bootmaking. We're going to talk to Bob about how Popov came to be and has managed to become a major player in the ever more crowded wallets, belts, and other small leather goods space, what handmade really means in a world where the term is easily abused, his descent into bootmaking madness, Toyota trucks, finally. Thank you, Bob.
That's quite the intro.
Why he wishes he could live at Disneyland forever. Ooh. And plenty more. But first, huge thanks to our sponsor this week, Standard & Strange. Attractions, Black Sign, Clinch Boots, Rolling Dub Trio, Lofgren, Wesco, they have the boots. Save the date for October 12th and 13th, 2024 for Stitch Down's Bootcamp 2, a celebration of shoemaking, the ultimate gathering for the community that loves it, Industry City, Brooklyn. Meet your favorite makers, discover incredible new ones, get sized into everything, spend some time in the Bootcamp workshop making stuff with leather, attend industry panel discussions, and then hang out all night with makers and appreciators alike. First one was pretty special, so we're making the second boot camp even specialer. Tickets coming soon at stitchdownbootcamp.com. And if you want to meet so many of the lovely folks you'll get to hang out with at boot camp, or just have a consuming need to engage in the finest boots and shoes and leather conversations on the internet, all while lending crucial support to this very podcast, we'd love if you considered becoming a member of our Stitch Down Premium community and its beating heart, the SDP Discord server. It's a good place. It's a very good place. More info on SDP and the Discord at stitchdown.com. All right, let's do this. Bob Henderson of Popov Leather and Bob Henderson Handmade Boots, welcome to the ShoeCast. I have to ask, and this is a two-parter, what are you wearing on your feet right now? And maybe more importantly, what did you wear while recently at Disney World for a week?
Okay, so right now we're in just some slip-on leather sandals. Like to have a pair to kick around the house, kick around the workshop. You got CF Stead Rapello suede uppers. Love those on a sandal. It's nice and soft and stretchy. And then I just got these, what are they, Dr. Sole Durlite outsoles. Super light, really soft, and it works well for a kick around, so you don't have anything too heavy pulling it off your feet.
So you made these?
Yeah, of course.
Nice. And wait, have I seen these yet? Have you even sent me pictures?
I haven't sent you specifically, but there's I made a pair last year and at the end of summer, and I've got a few out to the world, and then started a little sooner this year, this spring, making a slightly updated version of it. So I always like just having something you can just kick on your feet and go in the shop quickly, or go around the house, or go outside and then kick them off and forget about it. I'm constantly trying to come up with something better for those.
I have and continue to wear the like mule, I guess we'll call them, shoes that, as far as I know, I mean, the first things that you made, at least that were on somebody else's feet other than yours, was that style that was sold through Popov, right?
Yep. Yeah, you betcha. Like the boots and the laces, everything, that's like good and great. But I just have this thing where I'm drawn to a slip-on thing where you can still just slip it on, but it still works for walking around, running around. No, that is quite hard to hit that balance with a slip-on. So here I am wearing them still now.
I mean, I feel the same way. It says a lot about our really decline as a species, I think, that 12 to 15 seconds of lacing something up is really just a horrific thing to stare down. Yeah, but I'm with you. I'm completely with you.
Yeah, so there's that two part two there. Disneyland.
Disneyland, right.
Yes, Disneyland. Yeah, so I had to wear the Thunderdome boots there. So I was wearing the regular kind of service style boot with natural chrome XL outers, Dr. Sole Zumaz, I think.
Tumas, yeah.
Yeah, Tumas outsoles. So they're pretty soft and comfy and well broken in by now. Probably not the best choice for four straight days at Disneyland, 25,000 steps a day, carrying child, hot pavement, all that stuff, but had to do it. So they worked well. Started the Thunderdome with the Iceland trip, finished it with the Disneyland trip. I think these boots have seen it all now.
Bracket it up. I like it.
Yeah, yeah.
More supportive than the sandals. Come on.
They are more supportive than sandals. I brought the sandals, and the when I first got there, I had visions of wearing them the whole time, but then that quickly faded to the boots there.
I mean, it's a wonderful place, but, you know, a little gross, maybe.
Yeah, yeah, and boo watching, like capacity there is like over 100,000 people. So like I'm walking around, look at everyone's feet. Everybody was just like the full like super foam Nike walking shoe things there. Nothing else. So I felt a bit isolated.
Sheep. Absolute sheep.
Yeah.
So before we get into everything with the boots and the leather and all that, who are you, Bob? Where are you from? But also, I dare say you were doing some pretty interesting stuff before getting into this whole leather work world.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess brief history. Born and raised in Nelson, BC, Canada. Locating us, we're like a 2.5 hour drive north of Spokane, Washington, is the easiest way to put it. Going east and west, we're 8 hour drive out west to Vancouver and the coast, and about 6 hour drive east in over the Rockies to Calgary. So we're pretty out there, but also not bad, like 2.5 hours to Spokane and major airport and all that makes it pretty cool. Nelson as a town is like 10,000 people, but it's beautiful, beautiful town on a lake and big mountains all around. It's a really heavy arts culture, food culture, outdoor sports culture, all that good stuff of a normal mountain town kind of thing.
How'd that come about? Do you know?
Yeah, yeah. So I think Nelson, similar to all the towns going back further around here, all had like logging and mining and all that kind of thing for their origins. Once that faded out or moved to other locations, lots of places faded away. But I think Nelson's lucky enough just with how nice it is here. They pivoted to a tourism style industry, which was a good move. There's other industries around here going back to when marijuana wasn't legal and all that kind of stuff that were fairly profitable here. So that allowed the town to be supported by that industry, which had the side effects of all the nice restaurants and all the arts and culture and stuff too. Since we've kind of moved on from that though, but it was enough to platform it. And now we can hold our own as just a pure, pure kind of good tourist place.
Not bad.
It's a very rough historical approximation.
Were you reading that directly from Wikipedia?
No, but I've heard it so many times. It's pretty close.
Nelson.gov.ca.
BC.ca. Yeah, you betcha.
There it is. I almost got it.
Yeah. So I was born and raised here. Went to University UBC Vancouver for mechanical engineering for the usual run there. And then was lucky enough to be able to move back here to Nelson. And then the better part of my working life was using the mechanical engineering degree for it was a operations manager for a large automotive electronics manufacturing operation. So we're making circuit board based products and LED interior exterior LED based lighting products for Ford was our biggest customer, but heavy truck industry, other automotives. We did a little bit for Tesla at the end, Harley Davidson, all that type of stuff. So real big business, direct to very large players like Ford and such. So maybe at our peak, we had like 500 employees in Nelson, which was quite substantial for a 10,000 person town. So I did that for 20 years, basically from mid high school right up until 5 years ago. And that company got bought out and shut down. Pretty much, it was extremely lucky to have the opportunity at Pop Up Leather show up. They're a growing company with a really, really good thing going on, looking to take it even further. And just by way of timing, and their job description was literally what I did for my whole life and what I liked the most, except put into a fun workshop environment versus a very stiff factory environment kind of thing. Yeah, I've been 5 years at Pop Up Leather, and it's been absolutely amazing just to be able to do what I like doing best as a job, but in a very cool, very fun, completely new industry for making leather goods, and be able to learn all that stuff while applying some structure to it, but walking that line of not making it too factory like or whatever, keeping things fun, but becoming very efficient and very successful in a happy way doing it.
And before that, were you like working with leather at all? Or you just kind of traded circuit boards for that? And you're like, I swear I can do this, guys. Like, it's just operations.
Nothing really at all. Like, it can, like, I've done artistic things. Like this is an engineer speaking, so you take that for what it's worth. But but like, I was into arts. I can appreciate it. I like quality materials. I like figuring out what the best products are if you really want to get into something, all that kind of stuff. So the general spirit was there, but as far as literal leather working, zero at all. So it was pretty neat, and it's a good way to do it too, because then I can I'm not coming in with any preconceptions or this is how you do it kind of stuff like that. So it was really neat to be able to come in with a general idea of how to do anything in a smart way, but then be able to start from the ground up and learn all these processes working alongside all the people that have spent years doing it and picking it up and being able to kind of mix what I bring with what's already existing there and really make something neat out of it.
So you haven't been there for the whole, I think, 11-year run. You've been there about half of that. What's like the brief background on Pop-Up from your perspective?
Yeah, the brief bit here. So Ryan and Jill are the founders, Ryan and Jill Popoff. The basic story with them, Ryan got out of art school and was making some wallets in his basement for fun, threw one up on Etsy for fun. Someone bought it, made another one, someone else bought it, kind of progressed that along a little bit. Kept running that till it got to the crossover point of being enough to go all in on it and kind of quit the day job and make a thing of it. That was in Victoria started. And then they both have roots back in the Nelson area. So some point after that, they moved back here, still in his house making wallets, but picking up maybe one or two employees to help out there. He's extremely adept at the online game. So getting the website, getting the marketing going really helped out. Getting off Etsy, getting our own Shopify site going. And then going so much, the house overfilled, getting a small workshop in Nelson, which is still the small workshop we're in now, getting a few more employees, and then just building up and building up from there. That gets to me getting there 5 years ago. They already got 10, 15 employees and a bustling business, really great product. So still wasn't bad. Maybe 10 employees when I showed up. And then, trying to take it to the next level from there. So over the last 5 years, as a group there, we've really dialed in how we do our processes, how we flow through the shop, how we utilize space, optimizing our designs for the products itself, as well as how we're going to use it in the workshop and how easy it manufactures and all that. Bringing in a few pieces of equipment and upgrading some tooling, and just having a culture where the whole team every day is looking at how we can make things better and how we can do better generally. In the last 5 years, it's probably tripled the output while still keeping the same size little workshop and maybe adding a few people onto that. We're about 20 people, 20 something people now. It's been really cool to have some of those confines of the space and all that force us into being really smart and coming up with better ways to do things.
You have people running night shift now, right?
Yeah. It was getting pretty crowded there. Surviving COVID with spacing everyone out while still being in a tiny shop, and still we didn't know what to think at the beginning of COVID. Like all directions were possibilities, but then it became clear pretty quickly that with COVID, people just really love buying stuff online all the time. So we quickly had to adapt to upping our outputs while having all these other extra precautions in place for health and safety. So that was a fun time as well there. But it's made us better, right? If you just had a big dream workshop or whatever, you can do a lot of wasteful things and not be smart about it and still be okay. Whereas we got no room for error in the tiny little shop here, so we got to make every inch count.
Stuck inside that box.
Yep. One day we'll get out.
It's a good box. All right, so this is something of a long one, so buckle up.
Okay.
But, I mean, you mentioned the, okay, here's COVID now and oh God, what to do, but also like I'm going to buy a ton of stuff on the internet.
Yeah.
But even before that, but I think definitely since then, there's been no shortage of people, extremely talented people, who also just figured out that they love working with leather, right? Like in their own basement or whatever. Really only a handful of operations have reached this escape velocity where this business is running strong enough and you hire a bunch of full-time people. It seems like Popoff was kind of already there, but you've grown since then and keep building this customer base and grow. The days where it was a hobby are already gone, but a perfectly reasonable way to do this is to say, I'm just going to keep doing this and I can support myself and instead of legitimately growing this business. What are the elements that go into that happening? Is it luck? Is it hard work? Is it skill carried over from like previous work experience? Like, what's the sauce? Because it's very impressive what Popov has built up there.
Yeah, it's kind of all the above there. So like you're saying, like for someone to, it isn't too hard. Like you can see online, you can acquire the materials. There isn't too much like expensive equipment to really get in on it. So you can make a wallet, design a wallet pretty good. You can take nice photos of it quite easily. You can present that online and look really great. And I think you see a lot more of that happening now. But getting to the breakthrough part, like you say, so now you got to get it. So every day out there, lots of different people all over the world are compelled to actually spend their money on your product kind of thing. So there's a lot of expectations there to hit to make that tip over to a purchase versus just a nice wallet that someone sees online. So you can kind of describe it like you get into like a Barbie monologue almost, where like the customer expectations, like they want it to be handmade, but they want it to ship in 2 days. They want it locally made, super high quality, but that pricing's got to be competitive. They want it out of premium leather, but they may not understand kind of variability and like how easy full grain leather scratches and all that kind of stuff. And they might be weirded out on that. They want customizability to it, but they also want free returns if they don't like it at all. There's all these boxes to check in it, and it's really, really hard to check every one of those boxes without making a compromise. We do our best to hit all those boxes, and really it leaves you with like very little margin left for error to successfully navigate all those requirements there. So you have to be set up in all aspects of the business to successfully achieve that without compromise. So like on the back end, you need your design strong, both for the customer as well as for manufacturing. Like I mentioned before, getting your process flow set up nice and smooth for your delivery times, having a great mind for manufacturing to hit that balance of efficiency and quality, and have a great staff that's bought into that and really nurtures that culture, having great suppliers so you have consistency on that end. So all that stuff's kind of the back end stuff, to like the more technical stuff to get it going. So we get around to the front end, even all of that stuff, as hard as it is, you can kind of tick the boxes. It's textbook, you can figure it out kind of thing. Going around to the personal side of it is, I think, where we really make a difference, like your customer service. We pride ourselves on just being white glove, like over the moon, whatever it takes to make the experience right for the customer. We want them with us for life kind of thing. So especially with handmade goods, like you get this like personal attachment. And if like a customer doesn't like some aspect of their purchase, you feel like you want to get offended by it because you put so much hard work time into it and all that. So I think there's some pitfalls there with competitors or other folks, as well as just like the return policies and all that type of stuff. So we really pride ourselves on going the extra mile and doing whatever it takes to make every experience right for the customer, and then have them stick with us for the rest of the journey onward from there. On the front end too, just having the good social media, being interesting and engaging with everyone all the time, being really transparent. We show our shop processes every day on Instagram, and it's just walking up with the cell phone to whatever happens to be going on at that point. So we're not really staging anything or making any over romanticized images of a studio workshop type situation or whatever. So I think it's relatable that way and builds a lot of trust with people. If they ask questions, we'll explain what we're doing to them and they can see everything. And then just having the right promotions and marketing, and kind of walking that line and staying on the edge of whatever's working without going too far with pushing any buttons too hard on anyone, but still being available and accessible with great deals and great new options for people to either enter into our world or stick with us on subsequent purchases.
That's that easy.
That easy. That's all. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to start a wallet company coming for you. Here's one. Even people who have 50 pairs of boots, you know, you could say it's reasonable to have like two pairs of shoes or three. I forget the number. I got to write this down. But I think the average for Americans is like 12 pairs of shoes. You know, we're like, oh, we got so many shoes and we're collecting them. Like, kind of everybody has 12 pairs of shoes.
At one time or over their whole life?
No, like now.
Yeah, one time. Okay.
Like currently. That's America.
Yeah.
Anybody on the spectrum, like you only really need one wallet. And a good one lasts for a very long time. You could do a slight bit of belt collecting. People aren't like swapping out wallets every day. But here you are growing and you have employees to take care of. So that growth is even more important. How do you find that next customer? For one, just in like a very crowded space, like you do all those things right that we're talking about, but what is that and who is that next customer? Like, is it a person who's buying like a Fossil wallet, which are very much still a thing, by the way? I looked it up preparing for this episode, and like they're surely selling millions of them. Like, is it helping them understand what an actual, you know, quote unquote nice wallet is? Or how do you do it, this thing that you sell and you probably don't have to sell them another one unless they're getting it as a gift for somebody else for 5 years at least? They're very well made.
Yeah, all that is exactly gone through all our heads here before. But what you said on the Fossil one, I think, is the big one. Like, the market for department store, even high-end department store style wallets, or even going to whatever Walmart and getting a wallet kind of thing, like the amount of people doing that versus the amount of people that are in our world already is like we're a grain of sand in there. So as far as like competitors or whatever, it almost doesn't really matter within the real leather wallet world. I think we're all just trying to educate and pull in those people from the department store purchase, which is like billions and billions of dollars there versus our little grain of sand that we're working with. So I think there is, for all intents and purposes, like an infinite pool of folks out there that if we can engage them, whether it's through social media or whether it's through someone that we made a sale to telling another person, showing them their wallet or whatever, there's a lot of people to win over out there. And whether we do it and someone buys it and then one of their friends buys from a similar company to us or whatever, it really doesn't matter. As long as we're pulling them into our little pool and making it bigger, it's good for everybody, I think. So that would be the first bit on your question there. But I think, like you're saying, 10 or 12 boots, the same thing happens in wallets, funny enough. Like, we get people that collect wallets. Like, they'll have all four of our colors, and then we'll bring in a special, like right now we're bringing in the Oxblood from Seidel. We'll bring that in. Lots and lots of them are repeat purchasers where they already have a black version of that wallet and they just got to have the Oxblood version of that wallet kind of thing. So we get a lot of that as well. Also, just having like the options, like we have a fairly wide range of really small wallets up to like the big crazy trifold wallets and all that. So people sometimes will need different, like maybe they have a travel one or a business one or a home one or whatever. So if they really like the stuff, they'll find reasons to justify buying another one.
Yeah, people are good at that. The size thing is, I guess that's kind of been my little mini journey here. I'm always, or currently, or whatever, thinking like, oh, I should get a travel wallet, hold the passport, foreign currency, whatever. Like, I don't travel all that much, you know, and they don't actually like steal your passport from the hotel room. Probably more dangerous to have it on me during a trip. But something like that. But I used to have like the big old honking wallet full of, you know, I'm finally going to get that free sandwich cards and that kind of stuff. And then I was like, I need to get a thinner wallet. And I think the first one, it was before I was doing this, like I was, you know, into the boots and all that. But I'm like, this is where my money needs to go. I'm going to find the best like $30 thin wallet on Amazon, which of course I went through like three of in a year and a half or 2 years. Like, they actually do just fall apart, like not even leather, something vaguely proposing to be leather. Yeah, like the first good one I got was from our buddy Jussie at Guarded Goods. And it was like kind of the card holder, but then the slots. And I'm like, oh, this is great. We're like largely kind of cashless. Isn't that wonderful? Even though it's a little trickier than I want to like get the cash out. This kind of comes back to, do I want to lace up my boots or just put something on? Like, we're talking about seconds here, but you know, there's people behind you online. And then I probably had that. It was like a nice natural horse butt and it aged beautifully. And I used that for at least two and a half years. And then Ashland Leather in Chicago, kind of another friend of the podcast, Phil, made me one in Cordovan, like Corwin Natural Shell Cordovan. And like, that was pretty cool. But it had a little clip on the inside for the money and it was still there. And I'm like, kind of like good now, other than this travel wallet. I love that people are collecting, but you know, it's a very functional object in addition to potentially being, you know, quite beautiful and something that you just kind of like to play around with it all day. It's just kind of fun. I'm glad that people are also collecting wallets from you, and especially like these small makers who are making them, not, you know, some branded showpiece, whatever, but yeah, something that's like real. And that kind of leads into the next question. How do you help people distinguish between these luxury products from a luxury brand which sometimes are, but often aren't actually very high quality, which like is it going to fall apart, right? Like, does it use good materials? And something that's completely detached from that and the outward status of those types of product, but is actually quite nice and good and well-made and is going to last. Like, that's got to be tough, right? Like, these mega brands are very good at making you think that that is the highest quality thing in the world, partially because it's expensive, partially because of maybe how they merchandise it in a store or online or just that association. Like, what do you do? How do you kind of break that?
We put a lot of effort into like creating blogs and videos and just the wording on the website and everything to kind of help people understand that and get on with it. So for wallets, especially like genuine leather versus full grain leather kind of thing, that's kind of the entry point of getting people's minds opened up out of the department store world kind of thing. Because we still have people say genuine leather and they say it in a tone where it's like top of the top kind of thing. And then we have to be like, whoa, like this isn't...
But it's genuine.
Yeah, it's genuine. What do you mean? It's the best kind of thing. But it seems like the understanding is spreading better on that. And at the beginning, we had to put a lot of effort into kind of turning people's heads on that. But that seems to be a little bit more in the bag. On our end, like, we still hand sew all our wallets. So the education and the difference between hand sewing, machine sewing, and what a saddle stitch is, and the strength of our thread and the redundancy of the two threads and the stitch and all that kind of stuff there is a big thing to get people on board, regardless of any of the verbiage there, whatever, putting the lifetime guarantee on it 40 years from now, if your thread breaks or whatever, we'll replace it for you kind of thing. So on top of all that, just the giving them the confidence that we stand behind it helps as well.
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, it's a guaranteeable product in
ways
that many things aren't. That's nice. I swear we're going to talk about boots.
Oh, yeah.
Right. You know, listeners and Bob, but not yet. What tanneries do you use for pop-up products?
Tanneries. So we're running with two right now. Both really great. We obviously Horween out of Chicago and Seidel out of Milwaukee. A little of both of those right now.
Oh, I'm wearing my Seidel swag.
Yeah, I noticed that there.
Rich Jr. sent over to me for hijacking my podcast mics for a couple months.
Oh, nice.
So when the mics came back, yeah, I got this sweet Carhartt jacket that he told me I have to get dirty very quickly. So I'm going to work on that.
With the Horween, we have Chrome XL and then the Dublin Derby. And then with Seidel, we use the Double Shot, which is really, really nice. And then some similar Dublin type leathers from them as well. This year and a bit of last year, we've been trying, keeps things fun for us as well as the customers, but we've been trying to bring three or four other leathers through the shop and do a special run of that throughout the year. So we've been getting into a few different varieties there. We did some ghost leather a while ago. They're pretty neat for wallets and that. I don't know for boots, like as soon as you wipe it or do anything with it, it kind of unghosts itself right away. So I've seen a few people do it with boots, but.
There's some good ones. Oak Street just posted them. I posted them a couple days ago too in the Thunderdome. These Walvier ghost leather boots. I mean, there's still some of that wax on them. Right? Like a lot of it's gone, but
where does it stay in the stitches or where does it stay there? Just around down by the welt or
no, kind of like in everywhere, like up a little like higher on the shaft, maybe where the pants are covering it up. Yeah. I'll send them to you. Yeah. I don't know if it's like a slightly different formula that they've been using. Cause these things have been around for a bit, not widely, definitely not for everybody, but man, yeah, they look pretty cool. But yeah, with the wallet, just kind of rubbing in there all day.
Yeah. It's cool. It's really neat. We just got some samples from Walpierre there for some milled ghost. So it's a lot more bumpy and all that. And then they ghosted after that. So it's instead of just that dead flat surface that's super exposed to have the ghost wiped off, it's got all these nooks and crannies. So even on straight sections of the boot and stuff, it might hang in a little more. So I'm curious to get these samples and see what they're like. Talking to Oak Street there, they just a little bit of an aside, but they completely got me on April Fool's this year. They put it out like two. Did you see that one?
I did.
They put it out like 2 weeks in advance, so completely unsuspecting.
Yeah, it's a dirty trick.
The manatee leather, and I like Googled it real quickly, and there's like the first four hits seemed like legit other manatee leather-based products. So I'm like, oh, sweet. And I came into work, and I showed Ryan and Stacey, our designer, it's manatee leather, look how cool it is, blah, blah, blah. And then they kind of looked at me weird, and then I read it a little more, their thing, and there's a few questionable phrasings there. And then it was like perfect for your board meeting next Monday or whatever. I'm like, oh no, they actually got me here. But anyway,
it's good when it works. So back to the leather, like you're using great stuff, right? Like that's unequivocally great stuff. And a lot of brands, from footwear to leather goods today, they make a huge deal out of the tanneries that they use and the leathers that they use as a selling point or point of pride or whatever it may be. You guys don't. You've taken a different tack. Like, I search Horween on your site and it doesn't come up. Why was that decision made? What's the thinking there?
We are up front with all USA hides and USA tanned leather, which is a little differentiation that some people, sometimes they say USA hides and it's tanned somewhere else. But we present it as that. But I think we just wanted flexibility so that on our pages, we can, if we are switching around or using this or using that kind of thing, we could go between them and have that flexibility. Part of that was out of COVID with supply issues or whatnot. But even just in general, just to have that. If people know it's full grain, it's from the USA. If they ask us, like if someone's making an order and they ask us what's in it, we can go to that order and clarify which one it has and let them know and everything like that. But just to keep our front-facing stuff on the website, not have to change it around for every batch or this or that, we just keep it on the generic terms with the key points there.
Yeah, and I don't think that there's like a right or wrong way to do it. Like I think that way is right for a lot of reasons. I think the other way is right for people who are like, oh, well, I love Horween Essex, and because I know about leather from boots or whatever it might be, and so I kind of know what's going to happen with it to an extent, and I like it, and I like how it feels, and like especially Horween, Seidel, I mean, these are brands in their own right that carry a lot of weight, right, that say, okay, this is quality, and you got it. I mean, there's also this thing where it's like kind of running away. Like there's a lot of very good leather out there. There's more terrible leather. Or kind of non-leather. There's a lot of very good stuff that isn't necessarily something that somebody is deeply familiar with, like whether that's the kind of tannery brand name or the article or whatever. I don't know. I feel like from certain perspectives, like especially in the bootmaking world, sometimes people have become, in a very short period of time, I would say like over the last 3 to 5 years, kind of wary of something that they don't think that they know everything about. But it could be really good. There's kind of this like interesting crossroads that I think that the like quality footwear world is at, where if you're not presenting that or answering people's questions, but really like having it front and center, that there's like some doubt cast on these products. And, you know, in some ways, people knowing what they're getting and having an understanding of that is, I think, very important. Like we talk about leather and get very specific about it a lot, like anywhere we're doing anything. But I also worry that people can become maybe like too fixated on that.
I think with like the boots, if you're talking like a $500,000 purchase, you're probably going to want to get that deep before making that decision. Wallet, if we're like a $100 wallet, some people will want to get that deep. And if they phone us up or whatever, we'd talk all day about it and let them know exactly what's up. But like when we talk about pulling that department store crowd in, it's more the like the qualities and what it means to the person about that leather versus the name brand of it that's going to make that initial impact. So we found across the masses or whatever, it doesn't hold as much as you might think for presenting that.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that makes sense, especially drawing from that larger pool. Like, it's good. Trust us is going to go probably as far as you need it to.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, I mean, if people want to figure out how to turn themselves into total nerds about this stuff, you know, that's a decision they can kind of make on their own.
And then we get lots of those people, too. Like, they'll say, like, what part of the hide they want it from and reference one of their other products and make sure it's got a little more fat lines in it or this or that. So if they want to go like that, we're fully ready as well on that end. But again, across the masses, it's almost alienating to the majority of people if you start talking too deep into that. They don't even know what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, you're just throwing more information at them, especially for this kind of purchase, can be a fairly tight funnel once you get to the bottom, especially.
Yeah.
All right, cool. Yeah, okay. Bob's not hiding anything, everybody. look, let's take a quick break and talk about boots and Toyotas, finally. We'll be right back with Bob Henderson on the ShoeCast. All right, Bob Henderson, it's time for Gen Facts.
Oh, yeah.
As I think you may know, Jen works at Standard & Strange, is an expert at customer service, looking really cool, and facts, which are rarely actual facts. So once again, Jen has given us 3 of said facts, only one of which is true, and 2 of which are damn dirty lies. I'll read all 3, and your job is to determine which is the true Jen fact, which we'll do at the end of the episode. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Bob is ready. Gen fact number one. There's a leather theme here, believe it or not. While leather has been tanned and utilized by humans for over 7,000 years, with some early-ish uses including sails, instruments, and tents, ancient Egyptian women are thought to have first deployed leather for fashion purposes. Gen fact number two. Cricket balls, like baseballs, are wrapped in leather to this day, but at their advent, they were stuffed with an incredible amount of goose feathers before eventually moving to a solid cork core. Gen fact number three. More Britain. Britain's George III was known as the Leather King, as outside formal public events and while sleeping, he forewent traditional royal garb to have his tailors create outfits made almost entirely of incredibly colorful leather.
All right.
Don't answer now, as we will reveal the true gen fact at the end of the episode. So stay tuned. You got this though, right?
I don't know. It's a tough one, actually.
And now, back to the ShootCast. All right, we're back with Bob Henderson of Popov Leather and Bob Henderson Handmade Boots. Let's finally talk about boots.
All right.
I remember when I first saw the early prototypes of these kind of slip-on mules that you were making a few years back, and I was like, this guy just started making shoes. I need to DM this guy. I'm pretty sure we hadn't talked before that.
Yeah, I think that's what got it going, I think, yeah.
Yeah, I was like, damn, okay, here we go. And they're great. They've been wonderful. I wear them around the house. I wear them out a little bit. Like, they're, for the first thing that you made, it was like, damn. Fast forward a bit, you scaled those to where you're actually selling some small runs, and now you've evolved into, I would say, far more complicated boot making. I just love to hear everything about it, like what this journey's been like for you.
Leading into those mules that you had there, I was trying to think back on it this morning. It's been such a whirlwind the last 2 years, but the very, very first pair I made was like, I had no idea about anything. I didn't know outsole or midsole leather existed. Like, I thought our belt leather was the stiffest leather in the world and all this kind of stuff. I hadn't got into the world of all the, like, the Knicks videos and all the online stuff for, like, everyone showing how they make it. So I basically had the few years of leather working, and then on my social feeds or whatever, for the adjacent boot industry that started sneaking in on my social feeds and just getting, like, finished product photos of boots and stuff and kind of catching my eye there. So I like taking on side projects and challenges with the leather working. So then that showed up next as the next challenge. So the idea was to make some kind of, like, slip on loafer kind of thingy, which I figured would be the easiest thing because it didn't have laces and it was just a hole cut and all that stuff. So it's somewhat simplified. And then try and challenge myself to use the Popov materials, our style of leather, our thickness of leather, our style of stitching, and try and apply all that, but in a shoe form, so that the result would be a comfy little simple slip-on shoe. But if you set it beside one of our wallets, it would be unmistakable that the two were of the same origins, or whatever, however you want to say it. So yeah, without really any idea of what to do there, kind of came up with the whole cut uppers. I forgot about it now, but just thinking this morning, my last was, I think, three layers of plywood that were roughly foot shaped, we'll say, to jam in there. And then I had the midsole. Midsole was just our stiffest belt leather off the spine. I used our 3/4 ounce Horween for the outer, and then just used the belly off of that hide for the liners. Again, trying just to use what's available and challenge myself to those confines. Roughly shaped the outer on the block of plywood, stitch it down through the midsole, which at the point I didn't even know the word stitch down. I didn't know any construction techniques or anything. This was just a going for it kind of thing. Yeah, it all came together, slapped some rubber on the bottom. It kind of looked like a shoe. It kind of, like, I could wear it. I could walk around in it. It was, there was enough there that it was kind of eye-opening and very, very interesting of the possibilities. So then that kind of opened the gateway. Then I got deeper and then got into the YouTube videos and seeing how people actually do make boots and trying to pick that up and incorporate some elements of that. Getting my social feed full of all the usuals that everyone's got now, probably, which is really, really cool. We're lucky enough too here in Nelson, we have DeVito's Shoe Repair. And then the guys there, Matt especially, have opened doors and super friendly and very, very generous with sharing their knowledge and helping out with things. So I was able to pick up quite a bit big things as well as kind of the subtle things that may take someone a long time to figure out. They're able to just graciously share that right away. So kind of a consciously, aggressively pulling in as much information as possible while making personal boots over and over and over again and trying to roll every pair, roll in 3 or 4 updates to it. Shortly after that was the Popov slip-on, which you have one of the earlier pairs of there. So we did a few, 2 or 3 special runs of those throughout last year, which sold amazingly well. And we had good feedback on those. And yeah, it seems the customer service side of it, everyone's been happy and it went quite smooth there. But I guess screwing around a bit on my own with advancing to making the boots and having lace-ups and getting into like the heels and all these other factors that are complications that come on top of what the slip-on was. Just messing around. But again, I have like 2 full garbage bags of boots I've made and quickly discarded in our crawl space right now. Just making pairs, wearing them for a couple of days, getting some feedback, figuring out a couple more things, and then tossing them aside, making another pair because you're so anxious to want to incorporate these next new things that you learned into it. So I did that. That covers probably the first year of the 2 years I've been into it. For the last year here, getting a little more serious, wanting to get boots on people's feet instead of just flailing around on a bunch of different designs and trying weird stuff, trying to zero in on a more consistent pattern, getting a full set of lasts to build off. I think the first pair I sold to someone was a year ago, and then have been constantly selling and evolving since then, but on a much more specific path now, just to get that first nice solidified design and construction in place, which is pretty much where I'm at now.
Yeah. I mean, it's miles, I would say, from the slip-ons, which are great in their own right, but just not as complicated. What is the plan here? Anybody who's listening to this at any point, check out Bob's Instagram and the Stitch Down Instagram. Like, we'll certainly post some pictures of the boots with this episode to get a look at them. But where does it go from here? Like, it doesn't seem like it wants to remain a hobby, whether you want it to or not.
Definitely solid hobby there for a couple of years, pretty much taking over the free hobby time of my life. But probably the last year has been the transition from hobby to hobby business. So a slight differentiation there and angling it instead of just a excuse to tinker in the garage. Now it's an excuse to tinker in the garage plus put on a few more factors of presenting them online and getting some interest and getting a website going, getting online sales going, all that kind of stuff. All of that, I really like taking that on as from the hobby aspect as well. So like photography is super fun. Editing photos and videos is super fun. Even the business side, just managing the social media and trying to grow that and understand like the human nature and element of social media and how people react to things and what goes well and how to build an audience there is, I find that just as the entertainment value of that and in keeping it as a hobby is fairly important for the entertainment value of it and not needing to rely on it. I really like that world of kind of doesn't matter, just do whatever kind of thing.
That's a nice place to be, yeah.
Yeah, and then same, the social media one's a little funner and a little more immediate there, but it's same on the e-commerce side as well, just to have something out there for fun and see what people react to, see what you can do to get people confident enough to want to actually buy something from you is a pretty cool feeling. And then being able to service those kinds of needs from people is really fun. So just treating it as a hobby and all those avenues as personal challenges and just ways to have fun is really neat. So I'm pretty comfy in that zone right now. Really with like making the handmade boots, it's probably said a bunch of times before, but like you're not going to get rich making handmade boots over and over and over again kind of thing. So keeping at whatever, like 5 pairs a month or something like that is probably all your body wants to do anyway. And that's just the perfect amount to be that kind of hobby business kind of thing. It's kind of where I see it going. Then just getting better and better within that realm, throw in a few more options, get the constructions better, get the designs tweaked a little more, all that kind of stuff.
What's changed on that front? Methods you're using, equipment you've been deploying?
Like from the beginning, obviously using 3-4 ounce leather, because that's what we had available from the shop and all that. Switching to proper like 6 ounce leather was a big thing. Getting the full set of lasts in versus just the few random lasts I was working with was a big thing. With the last comes the patterning. So if you're married to a full set of lasts, now you can really dive in on the patterning, whether it be for the look of the product or how well it assembles together, and just making the tweaks to that and getting it settled in. Oh, my garage is, I probably have 60 different soles in my garage right now, and going through the process of buying all this weird, all these random things, and then kind of finding out what you like best and settling in with those, and then really dialing in with how those process and how they work in the final product. A big moment was switching from the hand sewn uppers to the machine sewn uppers. That really changed things a lot. So I was coming from like the wallet world, where a hand sewn wallet is fundamentally much better than a machine sewn wallet. It's kind of just a known thing or whatever. Coming into the boot making, I was pretty stubborn on always hand sewing the uppers, thinking that that was the top of the top or whatever. I stuck with that for quite a while. But as like with the slip-ons, it wasn't too bad because there's just like the one collar stitch and you can say it's hand sewn and away you go. But when you get into the boots, now there's many hours of hand sewing going on there.
Takes a long time.
Yeah, it's tough.
It's tough to just be accurate.
Yeah.
Over and over on a piece of leather that you don't want to put in those garbage bags in the crawl space.
So I was doing that, putting all the time in it. But then you planted the seed on this one. But the slow realization that like the look of the hand stitch and the bigger spacing and the bigger thread is kind of not what people are into in the boot world. That was like a total abrupt realization for myself there, where I think you were like,
oh, sorry, I didn't know if that was like a tough call. Sorry.
What? No, it's this is a good story, but it starts off with
the, what are you doing, Bob?
It's like, who's this fancy guy from New York saying SPI? What's going on here? And so, yeah, after Googling SPI and realizing what you're talking about, I'm like, oh, it's like they want even smaller stitches. I have to do even more work here or whatever. So yeah, that kind of started the thinking where like it's really, really takes a really long time. And maybe people don't appreciate it as much as in the wallet world or whatever. So
it's very rare for anybody to be hand stitching uppers. It happens. Yeah. But
and I think at the beginning that was part of the stubbornness at the beginning, just to have something totally unique. But then yeah, the value in a boot of what people put in it didn't correlate with the amount of time and pain associated with it. So started moving on to machine sew, and it was another really lucky timing thing, but I was able to acquire a Klaes machine, or like the hand crank patching style machine.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So it's a super classic big old beast kind of thing. It can do a few other things as well, but I found that as a kind of comfortable compromise where I'm still hand cranking every stitch and all that, but a little different than the hand sewing. On the design side, the hand sewing is actually like even more laborious on the design side, because every stitch hole has to be like predetermined. So as you're lining up your like the heel covers, the worst, the holes on the heel counter versus the holes on your side piece there, the two patterns have nothing to do with each other. The spacing, you have to like it's like a race course with the inner lane and outer lane and all that kind of stuff. That took forever and many iterations of rebuilds to dial in that. And then you got to do that for different sizes. And then if you change that for a model, like it was just proliferating to such a burden there. So there was some relief in switching to the machine sewing stuff, where you just need the geometry to match and glue it together and just run the sewing machine over top of it and sorts itself out kind of thing. It was a tough switch to make, but then it really opened up the ability to surge forward from there. So thank you for planting that seed.
Anytime.
Yeah, yeah.
God, I'm fancy. As somebody who, you know, often stubbornly is hand making these things, right? From obviously the leather goods to the footwear. What does handmade mean to you? And maybe what does it mean more broadly? Or should it mean? Or big question.
I think for selling a handmade product, you want to make sure that the elements of making it that come through in high value to the end customer, you want to maintain the handmadeness in those elements. If you take like the most literal translation of hand making something, if you're cutting the leather by hand with a knife and all that kind of stuff, some of these elements, like if you cut it with a knife versus die cutting something, and then you're going to end up sanding the edges and a bunch of other stuff happens anyway. Like in the end, the customer, that has no effect on the resulting value to the customer in the product. So what we do is try and find those items that don't have value to the customer. And that's where opportunity is to maybe add in tooling or equipment or something to get those efficiencies in there and still allow you to exist as a company that can provide a handmade product to the masses out there. On one end, you got, like I said, with cutting a knife versus a die where it doesn't really have an effect. But then on the other end, you can take it to, like for the wallet set, the hand sewing versus the machine sewing is a massive, massive difference in the resulting product, the quality of the wallet that you're getting there. We pride ourselves in holding on to the hand sewn element of the wallets and then do our best with all the other processes that may not have an effect on the customer to find ways to get some room there, get some efficiencies there, and then just allow the hand sewing to be what it is kind of thing.
Why is the hand sewing on a wallet so important? I actually don't know.
So there's a few things on it. If you start with the strength of it, so the thread, you can use way thicker thread. So I'm not sure what the break numbers are on it, but much thicker than even the thickest machine sew thread. So that's good. Next would be that you're using a saddle stitch versus, I'm not sure what the machine ones are called, but with the saddle stitch, you have your two threads. They're crisscrossing through, but they're completely independent of each other. So if you're talking for robustness of the product, if one of those threads breaks, first of all, the other thread is still doing its thing and completely unaffected by the fact that one thread is broken. And then two, if it breaks, it's easy to just snip and burn and repair it. It's going to hold up for ages and ages in whatever application you have it in, versus a machine stitch where they lock together. So instead of being independent and redundant threads, now they're dependent threads. If either your threads break in a machine stitch, now the other one's screwed as well, and they're both going to start unraveling kind of thing. Arguably, the aesthetics with a nice thicker thread laying down flat nicely on your stitches. So you get a color thread going. It plays with the leather color nice. It just looks nice and proper. And then also the holes for the thread are a lot more deliberate. So you can place those holes properly for your corners. You can space them through your pockets, all that kind of stuff. They're all part of the design versus a machine sew, which is just running over whatever it's running over kind of thing. There's a few things at play there, but aside from just the value in someone putting their time into it as well, but versus the boots with the wallets, it's fairly clear that a hand sewn wallet is more desirable.
And like from a value perspective, it's there, right? I mean, I guess you could go ahead and saddle stitch your uppers. Is that what you were doing previously?
Yeah, that's what I was doing. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that is pretty hardcore, but I have not really had a lot of boots that are, the upper stitching's falling apart, you know?
Yeah, I need you to do two rows or whatever, and it's pretty taken care of, so.
How long does it take to hand stitch a wallet?
Depends on the wallet, but in our spectrum that we do, it'll be between 15 minutes and 45 minutes. Like our trifold wallet, I think, has 13 different threads on it, so that's like cutting threads, snipping and burning and all that for the 13 different times, plus just the travel of stitching through on it. Say a 12-minute wallet, like a simple card holder wallet, where you just have like the L-shaped stitch around the perimeter and you're done. If that's 12 minutes, like you can machine sew that in like 2 minutes or something. So there, it is very tempting to enter into that world, but yeah, it's a choice.
Yeah, I mean, you probably blow up your brand, but it's easy to see how people would end up doing that.
And actually going, now I can use the SPI word there you taught me, but the SPI when you're hand stitching makes a massive, massive deal. It's not like with a machine, it's like you might have to change your bobbin a little sooner and whatever. But with hand stitching, like if you're a 4 millimeter distance between your holes versus a 5 millimeter, that's like 20% difference. So if it takes you 45 minutes to sew with the one, it could be an hour with the other kind of thing. So we've kind of dabbled with that over the years as well. We use a 6 millimeter spread right now. Some of our products used to be a 4 millimeter, and that can make or break the success of a product just there, just the cost in sewing a wallet if you're 4 millimeter, 6 millimeter spacing on it.
Yeah. And all of a sudden, if you're trying to explain that, not to an individual customer, but broadly on a website or whatever, to a lot of people, they're going to look pretty similar. And it's going to be the same materials, but one's going to cost a whole bunch more.
Yeah, that's another great example there. Like going from 4 to 6, really no one's going to notice that kind of thing. You can still manage like your radius on your corners. It still all comes out good. So that's something where you don't get a return on the value to the customer for anything in that range. Like some places will still hand stitch, but maybe have a 7 or 8 millimeter spacing on a hand stitch. And now you're getting into compromise zone there, and they can still say it's hand stitch, but like you can't round a corner. So you have to have straight boxed corners and all that kind of stuff. And it becomes quite obvious there that that, yeah, it's hand-stitched, but you've made a big choice to compromise there, and anyone can tell the difference on that.
What is your response to somebody online? I'm not saying this has happened, but let's pretend that maybe it could happen. Someone watching one of your videos and kind of screaming, handmade, but you just showed a video of a machine. Like, you're a fraud. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that's cool. We like all the online interactions are great. Like, unless it goes like fully off the rails, any one of these is really cool that someone wants to engage us on it. So usually the response on that is the similar thing. Like, we want to put our handmade efforts into what means most to the customer at the end, and anywhere where we can help ourselves make a better product for you on better terms that doesn't really affect what you're going to get in the end, we'll take that opportunity to try and make this as good for everybody.
That's just a wonderfully Canadian approach to.
Please, thank you. Sorry, all that.
All right. So you and I have spent a little time when we're not taping podcasts talking about Toyotas.
Oh yeah.
Which is just fun, but you've made like some crazy cool like leather stuff for your truck.
Yeah.
Which I'd love to talk about. And then you also told me about how the trucks have kind of inspired the boots, which, God, just putting all my favorite stuff together.
Yeah, it's kind of neat. Again, being in the mountain town here and all that, it's kind of like Tacoma Town or Toyota Town or Tundra Town or whatever you want to call it. But Tundras is what our family vehicle usually is. So the one we got now is like the 1794 or whatever. It's like the Texas Ranch package one. So the whole inside is all like an English tan leather with white stitching on it. And it's very like leatherworky looking kind of thing. Just by chance that happened to be what we got. But so that was kind of inspiration there. And then at Pop-Up, having a million square feet of English tan leather sitting around, started getting a little creative on the outside. So it's like one of the Toyotas that has like the racks and all the accessories on the outside, all that crazy stuff. Yeah, I started replacing all the pads and all the handles and all the pull-up things and stuff with English tan leather and threw it on there. Got like the pull-up straps for climbing on the tailgate because it's seemingly harder every year now to get up there, all that kind of stuff. So
you look great.
Got the the wheel centers are the coasters.
Yeah.
So the coasters we make at Papa of Leather are the exact diameter of the space in the center of my summer wheels. So I made like these little leather wheel centers with the engravings on them and everything and threw them in. And all the stuff, this is three winters now where I've completely not cared for or done anything to all this leather hanging on the outside of the truck, and it's all still kicking and looking great. It's pretty cool. We're going to try one of those mountain bike pads that go on the tailgate thing. I'm going to make a leather one of those next week, I think. So we'll see how that goes.
No.
Not too much? No. Okay.
No. Yeah. And then, so how is Toyotas or trucks, whatever, like influence the boots?
We're saying like both of our feeds. Actually, I don't really look at Toyota trucks online as much just because I've seen so many of them. So online, it's better to have kind of the dream world there. So I get into the like Land Rover Defenders and the restored old Broncos and the Land Cruisers and all that type of scene, which are obviously online, there's like ridiculous jobs done there on really cool aspirations and everything. So,
well, like I have to stop and look at this, but I'm telling Instagram to just give me more. It slows my efficiency down.
And then it starts all swirling together. And then like as someone wanting to make a pair of boots, especially when like just if it's just a test pair, I just want to try out a new process or something, then it's like all in on the experimentalism. So you get weird colors and just do whatever weird just to try a bunch of stuff and make the most value out of a pair of boots that I know I'm going to throw into the bag in 2 weeks after it. So start swirling around all this truck stuff and you start looking and I use it for inspiration. If you kind of go ground up on it, the tires and the wheels, you can look at the outsoles and the midsoles and then obviously the body panels and the uppers, whether it's all one or two tone or some weird combination, you can mirror a lot of stuff off the truck designs that way. You start getting into the trim on the vehicle. You can play that into the thread on your boots. You get onto the grill and any of the metal stuff. And now you got your eyelets and you can kind of see how those play off each other. And then especially on the Bronco, like the Broncos with the soft tops, like the interiors, there's some ridiculous interiors done on those. And then you can kind of play that into like your gusset tongue, which kind of acts as the interior look of the of the boot as well. So there's, if you're looking for inspirations, whether it's an all-in wacky thing or even just a few like subtle cues off of there, I really like between the colors and the textures and the materials, I really like thinking of those things at the same time.
God, that was beautiful.
And what's your Toyota? You sent me that one picture once. What?
88 4Runner.
Nice.
Yeah, it's fun.
The stripes on the side and everything.
Yeah, it's got the decals on the side. I owe a debt of gratitude to everybody who took wonderful care of this thing for 36 years before me. Frame's in great shape, and overall, it's fun, man. It's fun. But yeah, I used to have a 87 FJ60 Land Cruiser that was a bit more of a bucket, but can't break these things, obviously. Yeah, drove it across the country with every possession that I owned for like 2 weeks, and like in a move. I don't just drive around with everything I own all the time. On like the hills of Pennsylvania, didn't really want to go over like 61, but you just stay in that right lane and just keep it in fourth gear.
Yeah. It's the same with motorcycles too. Like you see the imagery of these older vehicles, and it's so cool in that. And then you get using them and you're like, oh, right, this isn't quite the same as what a new vehicle is going to do for me here.
No, but you know, there's just that soul to them. It's very akin to a pair of legitimately handmade boots or some of the vintage boots that I have. Yeah, there's just something to them, like these vintage old military boots that, I mean, they fit. I have more comfortable shoes, but there's just something wonderful about being in them, this connection. I don't know. I can't. I've always been willing to trade a little bit of comfort for something that I just think is cool. I don't know. Maybe that's crazy, but you know, we're taking the family on a road trip. We're in the minivan. So, shout out Chrysler Pacifica, a fantastic vehicle.
Nice.
But to offset that, you kind of like, you need a cool old truck, I think. And the kids like going in it, but I don't want to take them too far.
Yeah.
All right. Back to shoes. What else is coming on the footwear front for you? You know, are things going to kind of intertwine with Popov? Is it going to be a Bob thing? What's the deal?
I think right now, like, we're always bouncing back and forth on the back end at Popov with our design projects and all that. I think for short term, it'll stay as my garage being kind of the mod shop or the separate research and design thing there. But always looking for ways to bounce some of that back into the Popov mix as well. It's pretty tough, like making a lot of boots versus making a lot of wallets. It's a different kind of job for sure. So to have those mixed together in the same workshop, like with wallets, we have a water-based glue. With the boots, obviously, you got some crazy glues going on. All the sanding, all the dust. There's a lot of different things there, so we have to be kind of a bit cautious on how much we mix into our little shop. Is there for sure. We'll see whenever we have opportunities to bridge one over to Popov, we'll be doing that. And then otherwise on my end, I just want to keep kind of the style of boot that I have going on right now. I want to get that really solidified, throw in the option, like I have the mock toe option and a few options for a heel style, like a pull tab or a straight one or a few different things going on there. So I think I want to settle in and get those going really well, throwing in the sandals this summer. And then I think got some laces going on the side. I was looking at different laces and kept breaking the leather ones and breaking the cotton or fraying the cotton ones and this and that. So got onto the paracord ones and then got interested in making them. So kind of set up for doing the paracord laces now as well. That's probably enough to keep things busy.
Here's an idea. Non-slippery paracord laces.
I know.
And stay tied.
So you double tie those things and they never, ever come undone. But again, the act, it's like a little bit.
I don't have
bit.
Time to tie my shoelaces twice, Bob. We've been over this.
This actually, on Disneyland day two, between the walking and the eating, I physically could not reach my shoelaces by the end of the day. So it was like one of the sadder moments in my adult life of laying on the bed and begging the children to untie my boots, and then they're double knotted, so they couldn't untie the double knots on it, and they were already they weren't too excited about the whole thing, and yeah, finally they yanked them off, but so the double knots got me on that one.
That's a spot, man. Yeah.
Yeah. Like there's, I'm still learning about the paracord, but like there's a few materials, like you get the nylon or polyester. There's a couple other options there in different blends. There's some that stretch a bit more. The ones I got have a bit of stretch on them, so that alleviates the like bruised top of your foot thing. And the stretch gives a little bit better hold on the tie as well versus the super stiff ones that are slippery and stiff and just like impossible to keep tied kind of thing. So it's not bad there, but yeah, it'd be sweet if there was something you could single tie and also they just never fray or never wear out kind of thing.
Maybe like coat them with something. I don't know.
We'll see. We'll figure something here.
All right. Keep me looped.
Yeah, we'll do.
Seems like this would be the part where you just get to go make stuff, but we have to reveal the true Gen fact. Here it comes. To recap, Gen fact number one, ancient Egyptian women are basically responsible for all our leather jackets and boots. Gen fact number two, cricket balls are made of leather, but also used to be stuffed with the feathers of many, many geese. Gen fact number three, King George III was the original leather daddy. Only one of these is true, Bob. What do you think?
I should know, but I totally don't know. I know there's ties to Egypt. I know there's like stories like every living animal has enough gunk in their brain to tan their own square footage of skin on their body kind of thing. And I
always good to know.
Yeah, just in case. So that was tied back to Egypt, I think. So that's literally the only sensical fact I have that ties to any of those three. So I'm going to go with number one.
Let's check it out. You got it, man.
Oh, yeah.
Egyptian women. We owe them all. Everything, really.
Yeah, I edited out the part I wasn't unsure about myself, and I'll just run with that then.
Yeah, we'll edit that. Sure, I promise.
Yeah.
All right, man, nice work. Look, huge thanks to Standard and Strange for sponsoring this episode and the Stitch Down Patina Thunderdome, which by the time this airs will be done. So,
oh, yeah, I got to take photos here. Thanks for a reminder.
Yeah, me too. I might win this year.
Ooh.
So, yeah, go check out. We're going to have content, call to content on that everywhere. So, you know, check out the site and our YouTube channel and Instagram and all that. But there's just incredible, incredible looking boots there. Huge thanks to SNS and all our incredible sponsors for that. Support the ShoeCast by joining the bustling and insanely helpful and honestly just damn fun Stitchdown Premium community and Discord. More info on stitchdown.com. And make sure you're getting yourself to Industry City, Brooklyn this October 12th and 13th, 2024 for Stitchdown's Bootcamp 2. A celebration of shoemaking and the ultimate community gathering. It's going to be good. But most of all, huge thanks to Bob for coming on the ShoeCast today. This was fantastic, man.
No, thank you so much.
All right. Keep at it, man. That's it for this week. Take care of your shoes. We'll see you next time.